Welcome, everybody, to our regularly scheduled work session of today, which is May the 10th, 2021. I'm going to ask the clerk to take our roll, and then we'll turn things over to Mr. Meeks. All right, clerk.
Okay, Mr. Gibson?
Here.
Mr. Clark?
Present.
Ms. Kuhn?
Present.
Mr. Marney?
I'm here.
Ms. Rogers?
Here.
Ms. Therrien?
Here.
Mayor Matherly.
Here. As you recall, folks, recently we had a executive session, and then there were some items on there that we thought would work better in a work session setting. So here we are today to talk about response standards, something that the chief has been working on for a long time, he and Chief Kuhn, and then the administration. So I'm going to turn things over to both Mr. Meeks, Deputy Chief Kuhn, and Chief Chambers. And then Christy's here, too, from our dispatch center. To provide information. Thanks. Mike.
Well, thank you, Mayor, and afternoon, Council. We have quite the cast of characters today, to include Ms. Angela Foster Snow is on the phone. So we would like to have this as interactive as possible, and I've asked the team here to jump in if they think they can clarify something a little bit better or if I misspeak, so ask away. We have last time we kind of hit you with a shotgun blast of all this information, everything from all the different standards that could be used. We talked ISO, SEMT, everything from dispatch business funding model, aging population. That was a huge bite. Today we're going to focus just on one area, and that is this work session on fire and emergency response. When it comes down to it, the question that you have to ask is, what risk tolerance are we willing to take as a city, and what risk level are we willing to fund? Because it's impossible to fund zero risk. That's also kind of not a realistic goal. And one of the goals I hope that we have when we come out of here is a better understanding of all the different ways that people can measure the pros and cons of those different measurements. And because you now have been introduced to these other elements out there, you know, the funding, SEMT, the IS, so maybe we get it all clarified, and we can agree from now on to talk in the same language. One thing I've noticed over the 5 years I've been here, start talking in whatever language you want to call it, and then somebody will interject and throw something else out there, and it takes everybody off into a different direction, and it confuses everybody. Hopefully this gives us an understanding, and we can all talk from a baseline. Next slide, Ms. Danny. So there are the four standards that we're here to talk about, and of course, each of these standards could be a hybrid, so there's actually more, but let's just focus on the straight line right now. And it's the time standard that we've talked about, and we will have that in more detail in a minute. The number of responses. The hour utilization was first mentioned to you the last time we got together, and we went over that. And, of course, we could do no change. On the times, I think that we made it clear that there's all kinds of different time standards. Christy has a time from that she gets a phone call, how much time it spends. When she sends a dispatch notice over to the fire station, I think their times include everything it takes to get from to roll the truck, from the truck to the standard. So there's all kinds of different times. Tonight, though, we want to focus on the time that I think, and maybe I hope everybody else agrees, is the most meaning for the patient. Because quite frankly, I don't think a patient cares that it took 2.5 minutes for the dispatch call to take. The ambulance crew happened to be sitting near the ambulance and they're able to get out in 15 seconds. They care about, I need help, and when are you going to be here? And so if even time standards, is, we could have arguments or disagreements on which standard when you use, but if you look at it from a patient point of view, that might be the best standard to use. So let's go to the next slide. We asked the Downtown Association to put a survey out, and the survey basically said, from the time of the call, the 911 call, to being on scene, what would be an acceptable standard for you? they asked us to tell us to give them some benchmarks. And I said, no, we're not going to tell you what the standard is now. We're not going to tell you what the recommended standard is. We want to hear from the individuals themselves what they feel. We wanted raw data, and we got raw data. And unfortunately, because you didn't have a time block to check, you know, less than 5 minutes, less than 10, less than 15, we had people say, well, if I'm having a heart attack, I want you to be there now. But if it's something not that, it can be later. So the responses weren't helpful in putting together a statistical significant chart for you. In fact, the response level was also pretty low. And so what we saw was what I just saw you. There were four people who had the same common thing, and that was less than 10 minutes. We had about 10 responses only. It's significantly, it doesn't make any sense to use it, but that's all we got. But what we had already started to work in the next slide is on using time as a standard. What are the pros and cons for that? Well, right now, and Christy can elaborate more, once that call comes in, I think she has a clock that goes at times just about everything, and you can go back and figure out exactly what time the call came in, when the dispatch took place, when the fire department said they were rolling, and when on scene. So it can be easily measured. Christy, is the word easily? Okay, I didn't know if it's... we can, like I said, we can tailor it to multiple scenarios, but I still think we ought to stick with the time the phone call comes in to the time on scene. Now, here's where we have some cons. First of all, when that dispatch receives that phone call, we can't control the quality of information the individual is telling us and the panic level. So that might be difficult in some cases. And Christy, if you would like to jump in and say, do you see the issue with some people calling in is to pulling the information out of them, or is it? Do you feel that's pretty? You can do that and pretty quickly.
Less than 2% of our calls are callers.
Into the mic, please.
Less than 2% of our calls are callers that are uncooperative and unable to answer questions. So most of them will answer them. We do have to redirect them a little bit. We do a set of protocols that you ask the questions, and depending on the severity of your symptoms, you get dispatched quicker than if you stubbed your toes. So if you're having a heart attack or anything like that, you get dispatched a lot quicker. We get through those questions a lot quicker just based on the protocols and the science behind it. We ask a lot more questions if you're just having a general illness and not a chief complaint. So there are some times that we do take a little bit longer. Not that they're totally uncooperative, they just don't actually know what they see. If you've never seen anybody with a seizure, sometimes it takes a little more explaining. If somebody's having a diabetic problem, it takes a little bit longer for us to try to get them to explain what they're seeing to us because we can't see it.
So the reason why I wanted her to tell you that is because we don't control that. No matter how good everybody is in dispatch or the fire department, if the individual is making the phone calls in and it takes them longer, that will impact a time standard, and we had no control over that. So that's something to think about. We've already talked about that second bullet. If you pick a time other than phone call to on scene, I don't know if that really is of interest to the patient who's waiting for you to show up. And on the mutual aid, for example, if we have to call for Steese to come here, that is a built-in longer time period just because of the run, once again, and that's going to impact the time. So those are what we saw as some of the challenges. If you go to the next slide, and I know if you have the ones in front of you, you can't read it. That's why it's up on the screen. We asked Christy to go ahead and run a report by year that shows the number of runs per year that exceeded 10 minutes from the phone call to on scene. So right there you see that the high was in 2019, 1,095 calls exceeded the 10-minute threshold. And once again, you could pick a different number. You could pick 8. you could put 15. Matter of fact, if you pick 15, we really don't have a problem. Because then it was, if I remember correctly, the number was pretty low, exceedances. So it's just more data for you to grasp. Does everyone feel comfortable with understanding the challenges and the pros with time standard? Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
I had a question. What if they lived 10 minutes away from the fire department? Do you take that into consideration or not?
Go ahead, Todd.
We don't get there in time. It's as simple as that. We'll fail. We don't factor it in as a fudge factor or adjust the metric for it. It just means that they won't get there in time. The only answer for that is either, you know, for the closest unit, which has been being worked on, or, you know, you move a station into a better place. Like I said last time, we are planned and we are set up in a north-south orientation with the Aurora station on the north end, and our station's in a perfect spot where it needs to be for the majority of the calls. But the city grew east-west. So all of that stuff on the west side from Pegger on, it's a stretch, and we're not going to make it in 10 minutes, even if all the conditions line up. It's just distance.
So let's take a look at the worst case. Let's say over the years there is a new senior city community that grows, that starts being built somewhere, and it's at the furthest end of the city. At some point, you know, the discussion would be coming, if we're going to add a building, do we need to add another fire station to cover that area? That goes back to the risk again. What level of risk are we willing to take? Because if that new community did spring up, your numbers on scene would grow significantly, and you could probably figure out the reason why. You can go back and this is why. This long-distance run, and that's why you have multiple fire stations, too. Yes, sir.
as far as the survey goes, have we done that before, sent out surveys and had?
I personally didn't do it. I gave it to the Downtown Association.
Right, have they done that? That's what I mean. Have they?
No, I said, hey, would you do that for me? I just wanted to know. I was hoping to have. They said that their email went out to 2,000 people. If that's true and we only got 10 responses, that's not good.
So they say 2,000 people.
That's what they said. I had no way of knowing. I just saw the survey results, those 10 people coming back.
And 10 folks came back.
About 10. And out of those 10, about 4 of them were, you know, why don't you ask the fire department? Or
They weren't even.
They weren't.
Okay.
They weren't very responsive. Or why don't you, if I'm having a heart attack, I want you there quick. They didn't help answering the question. I mean, we could put together a more detailed survey, but that takes money. I honestly thought that we'd get a lot more response than that. All right, so go ahead. Yes, sir.
On that survey, do we ever do like a follow-up? You know, after, you know, on the car business, you always follow up, how was your, you know, how were you received? And so is that an idea?
It's been attempted over the years. At one point, there was a follow-up card that several departments used, and they would mail them off. We didn't get much return on them. You know, they tend to get tossed aside, or we didn't get a lot of response. Okay. It's kind of like that survey. It's a great concept, but the follow-through on the other person, I mean, they're having – sometimes it's their worst day in a long time or ever, and the last thing they want to do is, you know, answer your questions.
Any other questions on that? Next slide, Ms. Dean. So if you were to use time as a standard, we just came up with this, so it can be tweaked many ways. So the time standard we could use, when 25% of the emergency calls exceed 10 minutes from time of call to time on scene, and that exceedance is maintained for 6 months, then an additional ambulance will be budgeted. And this exceedance is calculated on an annual basis, is subject to availability of SEMT funds, and can revert back to status quo if response times improve. You'll see the same last sentence almost every time, because it answers the question, how are you going to pay? Now, if you're going to meet that standard, how are you going to pay for it? And here's one fact I hope we all agree on. If the demand continues to rise, and we don't add additional resources, the logical conclusion is that we're going to get, it's going to be longer and longer to get to the scene. And that might be acceptable. It might be acceptable to the council. It might be acceptable to the population. We don't know. It goes back to that risk tolerance again. How much money do you want to spend? I mean, if you really wanted to get down to less than 2 minutes, you'd have ambulances parked all over the city. But what's the cost associated with that? And so the SEMT funding, you know, we've been kind of expecting that for a while. It's getting closer and closer, but that is a possible way to fund it, so we're not handing a mandate out. Or you could put it on a ballot and say, look, our response time has grown X amount of percentage. If you want to keep it at the same level, it's going to cost this much. Taxpayers, are you willing to do it? You could throw it right at them and see what they say. That's another way of trying to gauge. You'll get a response on that. That would be a good survey, by the way.
Yeah. SEMT, I don't know.
That's the supplemental emergency funding that we've been trying to get for 3 years now. It used to be called GMET.
Yeah. Okay. So the extra money that we get for our...
Yeah. Correct.
It's all tied to Medicaid.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yes, sir.
So is 10 minutes the norm?
So that's a good... it's a compromise. So the standard that the fire service uses, and we tend to cling to the standards from the National Fire Protection Association, it's a good basis. So their standard is 8 for an advanced life support serious call. It's 4 minutes for the first responder to get there, 8 minutes for the ALS unit to get there. So it's usually rounded up to 8-minute response time for a serious call. And the thought there with the two times is that you're going to have more resources going to a serious call, and we do, and one of them will get there first and initiate, and then the other one has a little bit of time. If you usually have less ALS resources than you do BLS. That's where that comes from. There was some back and forth in my research for this between different cities exploring this exact same topic, and they did some medical studies on the efficacy of the 8-minute standard and found that there was no real change to patient outcome if they stretched it a little bit, and they got close to that 10-minute mark, and they finally, some of these places finally, I can't remember the name of the city I was looking at, but they adopted the 10-minute standard as being reasonable.
And a point there, his 8-minute standard did not take dispatch time into consideration.
No, it didn't. That was from the time we roll out the door till we get to the patient. And, you know, Christy's got a standard she's got to meet, too, and that wasn't added on. So,
and that's why we kind of thought, let's add the dispatch time and this, because, you know, he's looking at his metrics. But if it takes her 5 minutes to get the call out, his clock hasn't started yet. But yes. The patient's clock has.
Yes.
So
like
that's
Mike
why.
Says, the patient doesn't care about how we split it up. They just need you there.
Okay, let's move to the next standard if everyone's ready. And those on the phone, jump in. Let us know if you have questions. We have been using this quite a bit in a talking point, the number of responses as a standard. Once again, that's fairly easily calculated. It's... I asked Christy to pull the data, and she can give it. And if you remember how we've done this before, the questions were, well, I see that we're doing more response, but they're probably not that big of a deal type response. I guess that was the best way to phrase it. So then we broke it out, and when the report is made by dispatch, it's, what, 5 or 6 pages? Everything from, you know, sprains to hurt shoulders and stuff. And so what we did is, what you saw last time is that we broke it down to advanced life-saving and basic life-saving. And what that showed us is that the advanced life-saving numbers are going up faster than the basic life-saving. So that means the lower calls, like I hurt my foot or hurt my toe, those are not what are increasing. It's the more serious level calls. And some of you were privy to the senior population growth that we had about 3 years ago. And it showed that our over 85 population by 2028 or something like that, or 2030, was going to be substantially more because less of our senior population is leaving Alaska. They're staying here at their home. And so if you take the run volume that we can prove is going up, we now prove that the advanced life-saving ALS is growing faster than the BLS side, so it's more serious. You add the 85-year-old group that's growing fat that's going to be here. It draws you to a simple conclusion that the run volume will probably continue to go up, and the severity of the calls will probably continue to go up. If you're looking at probability, that is the most likely thing. Now, what could reverse that? If all of a sudden the economy went really bad here and people started leaving the city, you'd see those numbers going down. That would reverse it. But right now, the trend data shows increased runs, increased serious runs, and aging population that's growing. That leads you to a conclusion that we're going to have to address this at some point. One of the things that this, when you talk number of run volumes to a person on the street, it's easy. You say, hey, and in 2010, we had 4,000 runs. With the same level of staff in 2021, we have 6,000. That's something that the population can easily grasp. Oh, there's a huge increase. So it's easy to explain. What it doesn't do is show what the workload is on dispatch and on fire. And that's our next standard in just a minute. It just gives you a number. And if you turn the slide, you can see that it's been pacing right up. And every year since 2015, it's increased. That's what the numbers are showing. We see no reason why that's going to reverse or flatten out anytime soon. Yes, sir.
Chief, just a dumb question. Do you foresee any changes in what you have to do, manned vehicles, different kinds of things? Because 20, 30 years ago, you may not have had a fire engine follow an ambulance or something. Do you see any changes on the horizon that's going to make it tougher for you that might increase time that have nothing to do with the call itself, but the actual response? Does that make sense?
A little bit.
Like, you know, what you have to do. I mean, maybe you have to add another person to this type of call or add this apparatus to this type of call that could increase the workload to that particular call and make it go longer. Is there anything like that you can think of or...
I'll be blunt and completely blunt here.
Yep.
This department has utilized cross-staffing forever, as long as I've known. So basically what they're doing is they're using the minimum amount of people to do the maximum amount of work in the sake of efficiency. We don't meet the standard that we need. If we're going to measure by a standard for staffing for a structure fire, we barely make it for an ambulance call. On an ALS call, if we stuck to the NFPA standard, we'd have four people there every time. A lot of times we do. Sometimes we actually have more. We have five if an engine goes. I don't see anything on the horizon that's going to change that.
Okay.
The NFPA standard for staffing fire apparatus is actually five, but they'll accept four. And then they expect a truck to be staffed. But, you know, we cross the truck all the time, and sometimes that platform isn't staffed because we focus on what we have and what our call volume is, which is EMS.
Okay.
I don't see anything on the horizon to answer you that part directly, though, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
So these calls are going up. Do we have a breakdown on what kind of calls they are that are? Do we see?
Yes, sir.
This
it's pages and pages. That's why we broke it down to ALS and BLS.
Okay. Yeah.
And if I remember, Christy, you go do it. You've got them all, Christy. She's got tons of them.
Basically, anything Delta or Echo is life-threatening. It's severe. You're going to have difficulty breathing. You're bleeding, or you're unconscious, or altered level of consciousness. Those are going to be the more severe ones, or cardiac arrest. Chest pains, heart problems, those are all deltas and echoes. I can break it out even more. We have 32 different cards that we go to, 32 different chief complaints. So you have abdominal pain. And then in the questions, it decides where your abdominal pain or your back pain is to see if it's going to bump it up to a delta level.
So before you get too deep into that, because mm-hmm. I just, that can go pretty deep, I'm talking about basic poor health versus falling versus violence, crime, that kind of thing.
Yes.
I actually provided that for you in the budget report I gave you. So you'll see charts like this in there. Christy gives us a report every month about what our calls are, and they're broken out in this. And then I take that and I break it into this is EMS, and I color code those, and this is fire. And that's what I've been trying to provide you guys. So
okay, thank you.
Yeah, it helps.
One thing that's in...
I gave it to you last year. Would you like another one? I would. Oh, yeah.
You do them every month. I think that would be important.
Okay.
I can do that.
I just had another question. Does the time of the year impact the number of calls? Are we seeing our seniors leaving in the wintertime or not?
She has a capability of breaking it down by year and month and time. We just don't have it here. Oh, she just gave me a look.
I was just curious.
I was like, I can right now?
No, not right now.
I can do it, yes. I can break it down for each one every month. I don't have it with me, but I would say there's really no difference.
Okay. Then don't waste your time then.
Yeah. I mean, if it was Denali Borough, yes, then there's a difference. But in mm-hmm. Fairbanks, I do not believe there's a difference.
Okay.
And there is one point I'd like to discuss. Ms. Clark, you had the point there. Bad lifestyle choices. And I think we're all agreeing that a lot of us have, I'm overweight, okay? I've got that, I'm overweight. But when the phone rings at dispatch, they don't have the option of going into a lifestyle discussion. They got to roll an ambulance. I think we can all agree that there are decisions that people make over their life that have health impacts, but it doesn't change the fact that you still got to respond to it, still got to roll it, and still get them to a hospital. And
my question was,
we can only have four on at once. If someone,
I'm
was
shutting.
My question was, I think Mr. Gibson was kind of playing with that, the idea that is there things that we can tackle outside of what's happening here to bring these numbers down through education, stuff like that?
I think we are. You know, with the mobile crisis teams and the efforts that TCC is doing with First Housing First and, mm-hmm. and the other things that are going on in the ancillary, to get the high utilizers, those high volume clients that all of our circle of care interacts with, really, there's a few that are really high right. users. And a better strategy for redirecting them or getting them, yeah, it's happening. It's just slower than
yeah.
we need now.
Yeah. Do you these high calls also? We can pin them right. We can pin them on the map on where they're at.
You can do a heat map.
Can
you do a
heat
map, Christy?
That's a good idea.
I can with a little bit of assistance. Usually, it's only the police calls that go into a heat map type thing, but I can probably do that with a little bit of assistance. Or the area of town is kind of broke out. Their service areas are kind of broke out.
That might be really helpful to see where those.
But remember, on the heat map,
some hot spots.
You can have a heart attack at Fred Meyer's or Walmart.
Sure.
And
that's,
you know, so I.
Well, I think there might be a trend. That could be fine. You could find a trend if you look through it. Maybe.
Okay. Yes, sir.
So when you guys get back to the station after a call, do you guys fill out any kind of paperwork on, you know, what you saw and what was the event? And
yeah, there's two different reports. There's two different reports that are filled out. There's the patient care report that goes to the hospital, and that's protected, you know, patient information for patient care and billing. And then there's what's called an NFIRS, National Fire Incident Reporting System report that records the call. Now, it's just one call number for both of those. One's a report, and the other one covers what we did on the call. So they're both taken care of. We know who went on the call, what units, what their times were, all that stuff. It comes over from Christie's CAD, feeds into our system, and they have to write a report. And it doesn't matter if it's a fire call, a car wreck, a boat, a water rescue, or an ambulance call. An NFIRS is always written.
Next slide. So based on that rising, the potential standard that could be used is when the number of responses for medical exceeds 6,000 in a year, and once again, I just picked that number, then at the next annual fiscal budget, an additional ambulance will be added. And then the same sentence again at the end. And why I'm always, why we're pushing to the next year is that gives you an opportunity to actually budget for this instead of react for it. This is something that if it jumps over 6,001 one year and it's 5,020 the next year, there's a question from
Mr. Gibson.
Okay, please. Mr. Gibson.
Yes, thank you. I like this standard as one of the possibilities. My only concern is, and this also, I think, when you bring up the unit hour utilization as well, is that what responses we count inside that number of responses. Things like transports, interfacility transports, I'm not necessarily sure that we should include as part of those responses. And hearing the discussion and what I'm thinking is, I don't necessarily know if we can be all things to all people here. And we might need to look at a policy of things that we can and will respond to and things that we'll respond to if we have time to. So that would be something that I would think should be considered. Thank you.
Okay. On the transports, I believe we looked the number up. We're averaging 200 transports a year as a rough average.
I think 200 to 350 is what we're looking at as the number.
So for those that don't know what we're talking about, why don't you do it?
So there's a number, and you'll see in your budget report, there's a number of different things that fit into the idea of transport or interfacility transport. Some of those calls are from medical facilities that are asking for ALS services. Those we can't disregard, and we have to take. That's an advanced life support call. Mr. Gibson and I have had a discussion about this, about the possibility of could there be another way to handle interfacility transports or non-emergent transports. Currently, there isn't. It's something that could be explored. If the call originates in our call center, if it's, in other words, if somebody contacts dispatch through 911, they're going to send us. That's the way it's written, and that work belongs to our department. It's inside our service area, and they called our place. It would have to be some other system for that, and that would take some training. I do beg to differ about not counting them unless there is some other process change, because if we're taking away a unit that could be used for something else, then it's not available, which is at the crux, I think, of what Mr. Gibson is getting to. We're using, advanced life support, highly trained people whose primary mission is to respond to emergencies for something that's not an emergency and possibly outside of that actual mission. So we've had a good discussion, and I think it should be ongoing. For now, at this point right now, we have to count those calls because it's taking our units out of service.
Yes, ma'am.
So if somebody at the hospital at FMH has to go to Bassett, is that considered one of these transports?
Indeed.
And of the 200 to 350, how many of those are likely?
I'd have to break that down a little further. We don't have, in fact, Christy gave me that information. I should have brought it.
Yeah, we
There's
do
not
it.
That many trips to Bassett.
Okay.
There's not that many trips out to the other two that we get some feedback from our paramedics and our ambulance staff is the transport back to Eagle's Wings in North Pole. But there's about 30 or 40 a year. It's really, when you add it, it's more anecdotal than it is factual or statistical. The big ones that we see are from first care or urgent care, mostly first care, or the Pioneers Home.
Does the Fairbanks City utilize any type of volunteer system for
No.
these?
No.
Okay.
Any other questions on using the number of responses as a standard, the pros and the cons?
I just wondered, is 6,000 an actual realistic number to hold there?
Well, if you go back two, or maybe just one. There you go. So you're 5,000. You're close. Once again, that's 6,000? It could be 6,500. We just came up with that number because if you take a look at all three of the responses that we wrote, they're all close to being the same. We didn't want to write one response that's going to take 10 years to get there, and the other one was there tomorrow. So based on the growth, depending on what standard you pick, you're probably going to hit it if you consider this growth rate that continues.
Last year we had 5,366 calls for medical alone.
Feel comfortable with that? Okay, we'll move on to that next standard. This one Chief had to teach me on because I'm like, what the heck?
I had to learn it too. You're not the only one here, cowboy.
So the unit hour, the pros, it's a clear breakdown of the workload component, and we'll show you that again here in just a minute. The con is it's very difficult to translate that to the population. If you were to say we're going to increase your taxes because our unit hour utilization rate at the fire department has increased, I think you're going to get a lot of glassy-eyed stares because it's not something that is that they will immediately pick up on, like time response and, you know, number of responses. So it would require some education on our part to make sure they understand what that means so they can see it. And if you go to the next slide, Ms. D. You want to talk to
sure.
One? Sure. Go for it.
So the easiest, and we kind of touched on this last one, but, man, did you guys get a lot of stuff to absorb in that last meeting. So in a nutshell, basically, if you take, yeah, in a nutshell, if you think of there's X, there's only, you know, there's 60 minutes an hour, there's 60 seconds in a minute. So we went with minutes, and there's 1,440 minutes in a day, and then you just kind of divide everything out. It's actually, the math isn't too hard. I had to do it three or four times to make sure I understood it. But what we have based this on is we looked at how much workload is actually happening. So that first number up there that's all highlighted is the actual number of hours that we're averaging for response per unit per day. That's them going on calls alone, just on the call. That doesn't count reservice time, which can be, you know, short or long, depending on the type of call. But that's overall emergency calls that medic unit or that engine responded in a day, and that's what the time they... And the rest of it is, you know, how many hours that we expect of them for training for both EMS and fire. We do require our personnel to put in time in physical training. We need them to be fit and capable of responding and doing high workload demands at crazy times from a dead sleep sometimes. And then the other necessary, you know, meetings and well, we do station. We take care of our own station. We take care of our own things. It's an expectation that we have and try to maintain a be good stewards of what the city's given us to live in and house and work. So all of that factors in, and that's part of their workload. So you see that the ambulance crew, because their response load's a little higher, they put in about a 13-hour day every day, and then the engine crew about 10.4. So what ties into that is that doesn't come between 8 o'clock in the morning until 13 hours is up. It's spread throughout the day. They'll typically fit their workload, and that would be their training, their PT, and their like station maintenance and the other chores and other assignments during regular work hours. But the calls come when the calls come. So that can be scattered throughout a whole night shift where they're going every other hour, or it could be they sleep all night, and they, you know, that's increasingly rare. But there's typically somebody going all the time. Our call volume right now is sitting at 17.3 calls a day. We had dropped quite a bit, but we've had a resurgence last week. And so our average is pushing back up to match last year's. And it's all over the map for, if you mapped it out, and we did this years ago with Councilman Hilling, you cannot predict where that serious call is going to come in. It's just not possible. You can show trends. Every department I've worked at, shows that Tuesday afternoon is the worst time in the world for a fire, and try to explain that. I can't. I just can't. Anyway, but that's what we're looking at. Remembering that these folks are working a 24-hour shift, and they work two of them together, so they're there for 48 hours. We try to rotate them as much as possible, particularly on the medic unit. The hang up there is you got to have a paramedic on the ambulance. That's what we have in contract, and that's how we want to serve the public too. And when we're low on paramedics, sometimes those poor people are pulling 48 hours straight, and that's the busiest place to be. I like unit hour utilization because it shows workload. It's almost, though, that it's great for internal, and it could be part of a hybrid, but I don't think it's a standalone metric that, like Mike was saying, to get the public to understand. Unless you refer to it in broader terms, like the data shows that the workload has increased here, and then if they ask you for details, you could take the time and break it down for them. But
do you think that's because the customer makes a call that's about them? Your utilization is more about the firefighter.
Yeah, it's more about how we're using our resource.
It's not them that you're thinking exactly. of. So they made the call. They want you there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I don't understand how the sewer system works, but I want it to work.
Right.
You know, same thing, you know.
You're in a call. It's all about them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see. Okay.
Another way to look at that 13.04 hours is that we have city workers who have basically two schedules, night count and the fire and police, and that would be 5/8s or 4/10s. So here you have an organization at 13 hours. And if we were to map out the police the same way, I think you would see probably some of the same numbers. So there's just something else to think about. We're down to about 4 minutes. If we go to the next one, we showed you this chart last time also, and it shows that we're sitting right now at the high end of ideal, and it probably won't be much longer until we're above that ideal mark. And if you'd flip it one more time, Danny, the standard that could be written is that when the vehicle utilization rate exceeds 28% for a period of 6 months, then next fiscal year the money would program for additional ambulance. And the last sentence is the same we've been using on the other ones. So that's another possibility. Standards. Let's. Are we comfortable with the unit utilization rate? Not comfortable. Do we at least have a knowledge of it?
It's a good way to measure inside. You'd want to couple it with something for the public to understand number of calls.
Right. And so every one of these could be a hybrid. You could use a utilization rate with a time standard or with the number of runs. The next standard is the do nothing as is standard. And that is certainly an option. I do believe, though, it would be beneficial for the citizens to weigh in on that and to at least understand that. The pros on that is that the cost would not substantially increase. But the cons, I think you need to understand that, once again, this is not one-dimensional. It's almost like a 3D chessboard. If we start allowing this to go longer, our response time will only get worse. It's not only impacting the fire department and the citizen, it's impacting dispatch, because now you have people on the line with dispatch being very frustrated. I called you 5 minutes ago. Why isn't something here yet? And if you remember 2 to 3 years ago, other mutual aid, other companies said, you know, enough of this. We're not going to do your work for you. And they backed out. And the charts that we showed you last time showed what happened when they backed out. We've got to be able to keep using mutual aid. And right now it's the university who's doing our primary mutual aid. Mm-hmm. Yes. The other one's backed out. We can't afford for the university to sit back and say, look, we're not going to keep using our resources like this. You have to step up to the plate. Or we have to tell the citizens that it's going to take longer to get there. Next slide. And if we do that, I do think we need to have a PR campaign. We need to let the public understand that response times are going to grow, and that's because we're not going to increase the funding. Or let the citizens make a choice and put it on the ballot and say, hey, we will increase, we'll be okay with the increase of taxes if it's targeted to lowering the response time. That way that you got citizens' input. And at some point, I think we might need to do some type of PR on just when to use 911. I remember when I was on Wainwright, the dispatch worked for me there too, and we had several people call after earthquake wanting to know why we didn't tell them in advance that the earthquake was coming. And that was coming at the same time when we were having building issues and stuff. There is a lack of, that sometimes the 911 system is abused, and I'm sure that Christy could have a lot of stories for you. But maybe a public education on when is it appropriate to use 911. We have a minute. yes, ma'am.
Saying to the public, well, we can't do anything, I think is not the right way to go. And, you know, maybe a publicity campaign on how 911 should be used, but I think we need to really think about what we want to do to increase time responses. And if it does go over 6,000, that just seems to be a trigger to maybe increase our capability.
Well, I would
I
hope that
I just can't do it as is. I just don't think that's right.
Yes, sir.
Did COVID affect any of these numbers?
You know, we've been seeing a 9% increase pretty steady almost every year in our call volume. And last year it was 4.5. We expected a bigger bump on COVID at first in March and April. We thought we were going to get swamped because you saw the news, and it didn't. We honestly had a drop. And then it picked up in the summertime for no explainable reason, and it continued and it held on, and we had a 4.5% increase. So I think COVID was in there. I just don't think it was in our area like it was in a crowded urban area where there was a lot of exposure. And plus, we could seal off this city pretty quick. I think Governor Dunleavy actually, by doing the travel thing, saved us a lot of problems.
Yes, sir.
And so what... I guess right now the public's not saying anything, correct? I mean, we're not getting this. This whole thing is not spurred on
well,
by.
Well, first of all, the public, unless you're the one making the phone call and it takes 20 minutes to get there, that's just one voice.
Yeah.
But we as a city see what's happening, mm-hmm. and do we want to? First of all, do we want to have a common set of measurements, and do we want to be able to not react but plan?
Here.
I've always thought that if we can plan something, we can do it in a lot better way instead of always having a reaction. And if everything continues this way and we do nothing, we will be reacting one day. And how long does it take to recover from that? So this is not a decision time. It's just information for you. I would like you to see if you could, you know, what's next? Think about it. Ask people questions. And at some point, I really would hope that we could agree on some type of standard. It doesn't have to be codified or anything like that. It's that this is a standard, and so from next time you talk to us, that standard we would use every time, and we wouldn't chase whatever new idea of the day is. We can keep it consistent, and that way you'll see a consistent standard, and then you can see what's making the change, and then you can make your decisions based off that. So I would hope that at some point, hopefully within a month or so, you could come back and say, we really want to look at making this the standard, and that's what we're going to be looking at. Yes, ma'am.
This is June. May I add a comment? There's all sorts of good information here, but I think regardless of what we determine to be our new standard, the public education campaign on 911 really should be employed. I think just as a general rule, it's always
going to
be a benefit.
Yes, ma'am.
I agree.
I know the perfect person to do that.
Ms. Kuhn?
I had a quick question. What does it cost to bring on a new ambulance?
That is a great question. Mike and I kind of bandied this about a little bit, but we weren't really talking numbers. We weren't talking dollars. We were talking numbers.
You got to buy the ambulance, assuming that you have to buy an ambulance. And at first we were looking at staffing it with six, and that's what Margaret Reeder ran. But Chief came back and said he could probably do it with three and cross manning. So we could come up with those numbers. But then you got to remember, SEMT kicks in into account, and that would help out with those numbers.
Yeah, the three is not ideal. It's functional. And there would probably be some caveats, and you know, there's a lot of staffing is subject to negotiation. Buying an ambulance isn't.
The clerk is getting nervous, and she's giving me the eye. Okay, she said we're fine. Yes, ma'am.
Just one comment. When we start looking at the money that we're getting with COVID, we're getting over $4 million plus we're getting money from the state. I think we really need to consider this in deciding what we're going to do with those funds.
Remember, that's only three-year money, though.
I understand, but we need to think about how we're going to use those, yep. And this is a good goal.
Thank you. Right. With that, sir?
I think we're good.
She has the numbers for six people. If we can get that to you afterwards, I think we got to go. I appreciate the time, and I hope we scaled it down. And if you want other parts and pieces of this, ask us questions, and thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Council. We're adjourned till 6:30. We'll reconvene then. Thank you.